Hello and welcome to Parle, the Hindu's weekly podcast discussing questions of contemporary relevance. I am Sudipta Datta, your host for today. In 2017, the Supreme Court refused to delve into the question of marital rape of adult women while examining an exception to Section 375 of the Indian Penal Code, which allows a man to force sex on his wife. Recent rulings by high courts have been contradictory. One backed marital rape as a valid ground for divorce. Another granted anticipatory bail to a man while concluding that forcible sex is not an illegal thing. Why do differences persist despite the Justice J.S. Verma Committee recommendation to criminalize marital rape? Today we'll be discussing why marital rape has not been criminalized in India yet. Joining me are Shraddha Chaudhary, lecturer, Jindal Global Law School, and Manuraj Shunmuga Sundaram, who's advocate, Madras High Court, and spokesperson of the DMK.
Good morning, Mrs. Sundaram and Ms. Chaudhary. Thank you for joining this Parle discussion that we are having on marital rape. So I'll start by asking this question. The recent rulings by the High Court pointing out that any sexual act by a man against his wife, even if it involves force, is not rape. And this perhaps highlights the lacuna in the penal code, which does not recognize marital rape. So is there a loophole in the Indian penal code? And if there is, how can it be corrected? And also, I wanted to ask that why does a provision like this exist in the IPC in the first place in a liberal democracy like ours? So Ms. Chaudhary, would you like to start by taking this?
Yeah. This is a really good question. The IPC generally defines sexual offences in a gender-specific way, right? So men may be perpetrators and women may be victims within the scheme of the law. Now, Section 375 specifically defines the offence of rape, and it lays down which physical acts are required to make out the offence. And it's a very broad definition. It includes a wide range of penetrative acts. The second important element of this definition is consent. So where any of these penetrative acts are done without the consent of the woman, then the offence of rape is made out. Now, this is the general rule. There is an exception to this rule, and that's what we're concerned with today. The exception says that sexual acts by a husband with his wife, provided that she is 18 years of age, would not be rape. So what's happening here is that while the rest of the provision is centered on consent, this exception doesn't talk about consent at all. It creates a legal fiction. It deems that a wife always consents to her husband, which in effect means that her non-consent is irrelevant. Now, of course, it is possible for there to be reprieve for rape within a marriage, but not as rape. If there are physical injuries, then there can be reprieve for that separately. Marital rape may be recognized as a form of cruelty. It may be a ground for divorce, right? But it's not punished as a wrong of rape, which is a very distinct wrong and has very distinct harms. So that is where the lacuna in the law really lies. Now, insofar as fixing it is concerned, either the parliament may legislate and remove this exception, or a constitutional court has to strike it down. And those are really the two ways to do it. Should we hear from Mr. Manu about this before we go on to why it exists?
Yes. Mr. Sundaram, I would like you to lend your thoughts about this.
Thank you, Stita. No, I have very little to add to what has been extremely, well articulated by Ms. Shraddha Chaudhary. Except perhaps to answer one other part of your question, which is, how did we end up with this, right? Why did we end up here? And partly the answer is because we inherited an Indian penal code, which is, prior to the enactment of the constitution, but that does not absolve us of the deficiencies in the present legal structure and legal fiction, as Shraddha has said. Now, it is not the case that, other countries like the United Kingdom have continued with this legal fiction. In fact, in 1991, the House of Lords was very categorical when it said that you cannot maintain that that by marriage alone, a wife submits herself irrevocably to sexual intercourse in all circumstances. And this subsequently was enacted as the Sexual Offenders Act in 2003. So the so-called marital rape immunity, or the exception to rape as we've structured it in our Indian Penal Code, has been done away with in other jurisdictions, and rightly so. And as Shraddha has pointed out, of course, marital rape today exists in a very unique sort of stratosphere, wherein it can be a ground for cruelty and therefore for divorce under the personal laws, but it will not render the offender guilty of the offense itself.
So where does the fault lie? Is it with Parliament, which has failed to legislate it, or it's more complicated, or is it a more complicated situation here? I mean, why do we still have it then? Ms. Chaudhary, please.
So, yeah, I think you're right in saying that it is a bit more complicated than just saying that the Parliament has not legislated. Of course, I think primarily it should have fallen to the Parliament to legislate on this and to remove this exception. But we should also keep in mind that courts have also, you know, noted the cruelty of this exception, and they've acknowledged its problems.
Especially the Supreme Court.
Yes, and they've not gone on to strike it down entirely. So I think it is on both sides a bit. As far as the Parliament is concerned, you see that it is quite common to leave legislation that may not give very good political returns to the court. We saw this with Section 377 as well. It had to be struck down by the court finally. So it is, in that sense, perhaps a political decision by the Parliament, and regardless of ideology, to not legislate on this subject.
Okay. Mrs. Sundaram, I want to bring you in here with this question. But why was the recommendation of the Justice J.S. Verma Committee on marital rape not accepted when the IPC was amended in 2013? Because it was part of the recommendation that it be criminalized.
Yes, and I will quickly answer that, but I also want to add something to what was earlier said about the Parliament and the court.
Legislation. Yeah, please go ahead.
So, you know, the Parliament, as Shraddha has rightly pointed out, there are, you know, some sort of limitations. Though these are limitations only in the minds of people, not real limitations. But nevertheless, the Parliament, I believe, did miss an opportunity to enact changes as recommended by the Justice Verma Committee. The official response of the ministers of the cabinet, of the council at that point of time, is they wanted further discussions around marital rape laws before they could enact it, because it involved other questions of law as well. There might be some element of truth to that, but it definitely exposes a vulnerability to issues that may not have political mileage, or in fact may have other sort of political ramifications. Nevertheless, again, as Shraddha has pointed out, and as we are sort of coming to the third anniversary of the Navtej Singh Johar judgment, the Supreme Court, the ultimate guardian of constitutional rights, or the sentinel qui vive, as we often remark in many of our op-eds, has, I think, missed a fantastic opportunity when it had an occasion to go into these matters in the Independent Thought case in 2017. Now, like with Navtej Johar, when the Supreme Court, according to me, missed an opportunity to provide the entire spectrum of civil, marital, inheritance, succession rights to non-heterosexual couples, I think the Supreme Court equally missed an opportunity during the course of the Independent Thought case to extend its sort of remit to look at all forms of marital rape, not only that restricted to women below the age of 18 years. The actual reason given by the Supreme Court during Independent Thought is that we have refrained from making any observation with regard to marital rape because the issue is not before us at all. But that's not quite fair, in my opinion, because the Supreme Court, as we know, under Article 142, has powers to, you know, almost equivalent to that of a lawmaking power. So they could have gone in, they realized there is a vacuum here, and that they realized, obviously, that this is a fundamental rights issue And the Supreme Court should not wait for petitioners to bring individual cases for constitutional adjudication, but could have taken the initiative. So I would say it's an opportunity missed by Parliament in 2013 and the Supreme Court in 2017.
Right, right. Ms. Chaudhary, do you think that that's what it should be? It should have been removed completely when they were reading down the exception to Section 375?
Yeah, I think what Manu said makes complete sense. There was an opportunity before the court, and the court made the decision to restrict itself only to the question of minors. And then that case was constructed in a way that it became about, you know, parity between the Indian Penal Code on the one hand and the Protection of Children from Sexual Offences Act on the other. So in the end, it became about parity between those two and child rights and protecting children. So the question of adult women was consciously left out. He's right in saying that it need not have been that way. But I'm sure there will also be a lot of constitutional commentators who will talk about the merits of, you know, judicial restraint. So an argument can be made that way as well. But I am personally in agreement with Manu here that it could have been that way. But just to add to the last question about why in 2013 this change was not made, we should also keep in mind that more recently in 2019, Dr. Shashi Tharoor has introduced a private member's bill to criminalize marital rape. And even that has not, you know, come to anything yet. And it seems that there is definitely within Parliament, especially, a sense that there will not be a lot of public support for a decision like this. And, you know, perhaps that's not very incorrect of them. By incorrect, I mean that perhaps that is not very inaccurate, because a lot of people, including, you know, educated people who otherwise seem liberal minded, still believe that criminalizing marital rape will somehow threaten the institution of marriage and will become some sort of witch hunt against husbands, right? And I think perhaps the government did not feel prepared to counter these arguments. I was just saying that these arguments go back to the Victorian morality of the IPC in 1860, which the IPC has continued and which we have tried to counter through the years, but have not quite done it fully or as well as perhaps we would have liked to. And that morality also captured, you know, the common law of coverture, under which women had no rights after marriage. Their rights were to be exercised by their husbands. And they were so completely reduced to the status of chattel, of property. And so it was simply presumed that, you know, their consent would not matter. They would have a duty to submit to the sexual whims of their husbands. And so the construction then of the woman becomes as the object of male sexual desire rather than a subject who has her own wishes, her own desires, and can say no, can govern her own body. So all of these things then become connected. It informs the way that we think of marriage. It informs the way that we think of, you know, how husbands will, quote unquote, suffer if such a provision is brought in.
So Mrs. Sundaram, I wanted to go to the next question that you also mentioned it before, that most of the countries have now criminalized marital rape, and judgments of courts such as the European Court of Human Rights have stressed on the offense and violence of rape, rather than the relationship between the perpetrator and the victim. To what extent are these developments relevant to India? Do we need to sensitize people a little more?
Well, they are extremely relevant in terms of how our own jurisprudence could shape and evolve in the coming years. Of course, you've seen how LGBTQ jurisprudence over the last 15 years in other countries, I would say, has impacted to some extent how India's own jurisprudence from Navtej Johar has changed with regard to LGBTQ rights. So we cannot ignore these developments around us, but ultimately the recognition of the perversity of the marital rape exception must come from within. And for that, we only need to look towards Article 14. Now, the most compelling argument in support of the marital rape exception as it is prevalent in our statute today is that the institution of marriage is sacrosanct and that it should not be disturbed or any such. But one must only try to understand the Constitution places no importance on any particular institution. The Constitution is unequivocal in its significance given to the individual. So the person deserves equality. The person deserves, you know, equal protection.
Dignity and autonomy.
Exactly. So therefore, this entire legal fiction, again, as Shraddha has described it, of marriage, which then, you know, provides you this exception to marital rape, in itself is unconstitutional and violative of what we consider to be, you know, the heart and soul, Article 14 of the Constitution. Now, as you rightly put, these are all offenses which involve or are against bodily integrity. You know, just because the nature of the or the relationship of between the victim and the offender is one of marriage, it does not absolve the crime. It is akin to saying that, you know, two people can enter into a contract and then one person can be abused or denied fundamental rights on the basis of that contract, which again would fall short and will be violative of our constitutional rights. And finally, you know, I think what we've come to understand in terms of the institution of marriage is that there is an option today for people to leave the institution. There is an option that people live with dignity and can, you know, file for divorce, even file for divorce under mutual consent and, you know, in the days to come under irretrievable breakdown of marriage. So therefore, this entire sort of argument that is built around marriage, institution of marriage and its sanctity, I think needs to be broken, and which is what has happened in I think other jurisdictions around us. And ultimately, once we realize that, I think we will then move towards a more sort of, you know, a fairer deal for women under the rape provisions.
Ms. Chaudhary, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, just I think that makes a lot of sense. But just I just wanted to add one more point, is that not from the judgments perhaps specifically, but there is beyond that something we can learn from the experiences of these countries after they have actually criminalized marital rape. And the first thing we can see from that is that it did not lead to a witch hunt against husbands, and it definitely did not lead to some sort of end of marriage as an institution or the destruction of marriage. Marriage is very much thriving everywhere else, although perhaps it's just become more of a choice in other countries. And the second thing that perhaps we can learn is that, yes, there are socioeconomic differences between India and some of the countries that have criminalized marital rape. And I was reading that the government has used that as well as a rationale against criminalizing marital rape, to say that there is a lot of poverty and illiteracy and diversity in this country, which makes this complex. And that's true. It does make it complex. But we need to question to what extent these issues map on to the issue of marital rape, and to what extent we can let them hamstring us, right? When the Constitution was adopted, our framers knew the conditions of the country. They were the same then as they are now. Perhaps they are a bit better now. And even then, we aspired for a better India at that time. We aspired to end discrimination, whether it's based on gender or caste, and to have a thriving liberal democracy based in equality, right? As Mr. Sundaram rightly pointed out, Article 14 is at the heart of all this. And insofar as these values are concerned, we definitely have more in common with the countries that have criminalized marital rape than those which have not. So those are definitely things we can learn.
Okay. So even considering that it's a complex issue, I wanted to ask both of you one question. That, you know, what are the hurdles in reporting and prosecuting a crime like marital rape? And especially, how is it different from other kinds of rape? Will it be different? So, Mr. Sundaram, would you like to take that first?
Sure. To me, I don't think it is very different. And I don't think we should view it any more challenging to report a so-called, you know, marital rape as opposed to any other act of sexual violence. most of these acts, I mean, empirically and anecdotally, we know, are away from sort of eyewitnesses, and to lead evidence is a challenge in itself. So therefore, I don't see why marital rape should be particularly more difficult to report or prove in court than any other sexual offense. Now, the only sort of legal, like, fiction, again, I use this term because I think it's the most appropriate term, the only legal fiction created is the institution of marriage means that consent is given once and for all, so long as that institution exists, which I think is the notion that needs to be broken down. Consent must be gotten or obtained for every act. It needs to be act-wise consent. So therefore, this entire, you know, question of reporting, so once you remove that understanding that consent is given as soon as the garlands are exchanged or rings are exchanged during the wedding day, then you will then start looking at this as consent per act. So then once you start doing that, how is this any different from any other sexual violence, you know, that happens outside or inside a relationship, marital or otherwise? And secondly, I just want to say, look, even if you see in the last 10 years, the POCSO Act, which, you know, criminalizes child sexual offenses, has really been important sort of step in ensuring that there is justice for child sexual abuse victims. Now, we know empirically and anecdotally that most offenders of child sexual abuses are within the family, but we don't give them immunity, right? We don't say there's an institution of family, so let's protect offenders who are within the same family. I think we need to show that it is as absurd as asking for protection of a family member from a child sexual abuse as it is to say a husband from a marital rape crime act offense.
Right. Ms. Chaudhary, would you like to add? Or?
Yeah, really, just one thing that I thought of over and above this was that the marital space or the marital relationship we've seen with the Domestic Violence Act or Section 498A does create issues in reporting and prosecuting, but that is not because of the nature of the offense or what is being criminalized. The issues, as I think Mr. Sundaram hinted at, are because of the way that the functionaries in the criminal justice system think and perceive these things. So the police and then judges and, you know, prosecutors, anyone who is involved in the system with whom the victim will have to interact, it is they who are likely to create, unwittingly or, you know, intentionally create barriers in reporting and prosecution, because in their minds, this legal fiction of, you know, consent being presumed within a marriage may persevere even if the law happens to be changed. And so that is what will need to really be targeted. And we can probably learn quite a bit from the POCSO as well in this regard. The issues of reporting which come from knowing the offender can be seen in the POCSO Act, the fear that comes from it, the access, the intimidation that comes from it. And so those are likely to map on to something like marital rape as well. And so targeted, you know, sensitization of functionaries and having social workers to help out and having, you know, good rules and guidelines in place, all of these will be important in making a law that criminalizes marital rape actually work, actually be implemented. Otherwise, you know, it just stays on paper and nothing really comes of it.
Right. So this brings me to my last question, really. Like, would you agree that social structures that justify violence against women, or patriarchal mindsets, or misogynist, you know, attitudes, they have remained the same and therefore pose a challenge to the implementation of laws on rape? I mean, how much does that need to change, the social mindset? Even if laws are amended, but have mindsets changed to sort of implement the laws? Mr. Sundaram, you first.
Sure. So, yes, absolutely no question about that, you know. So even when I criticize the parliament and the judiciary, you know, these are still people who are part of our larger society. So societal change is very important, and it is not only the patriarchy or the misogyny that needs to change, according to me, as you put it. We need to go further. We need to challenge notions about, like I said, the sanctity of marriage. We need to check ourselves every time we indulge in blaming the victim, because every sexual offense, the initial sort of response is to raise questions around the victim. So that needs to also change. We also need to, I think, challenge our own sort of traditional or conservative mindsets when it comes to discussing sexual offenses or offenses that take place within the family. Just going back to POXO, even till date, POXO crimes are heavily underreported because most of the abuse is within the family. So therefore, all these sort of mindsets need to change. It's patriarchy is by and large the most sort of overbearing of these. But of course, like I said,
there are hundreds of other things as well that need to change.
Yes, yes.
Ms. Chaudhary?
Yes, that's completely right. And just in tune with that, I think it's when we talk about expanding the scope of these social structures which you know justify violence against women, and then also violence against other, whether it's gender minorities or it's children or other classes of people based on caste, all of these come from resistance to privilege. There have existed certain power structures in societies that have typically been based on, you know, in our society, especially on caste and then on gender. And these power structures are challenged by laws, for instance, that criminalize rape, laws that then, as Mr. Sundaram has pointed out, you know, question this sanctity that is given to marriage, this special place that is given to marriage. All of these laws question privilege and power. And whenever laws question privilege and power, the rhetoric of misuse, the rhetoric of, you know, this is going to destroy society as we know it, always come in. And that is the strongest, you know, kind of weapon that is operationalized against the implementation of these laws. And it's important to counter those narratives as well, to establish that, you know, that misuse is extremely unlikely. And as Mr. Sundaram said, to believe victims, to believe complainants. And B, that this hullabaloo of misuse is a red herring. And in fact, should not become the reason why we don't extend protections at all. Perhaps there is no law in existence that is not at some level or by some person being misused. But you will notice that it is only laws which protect the disadvantaged, the impoverished, the, you know, discriminated, which people talk about as being misused. They don't talk about other laws being misused. So we need to see through this red herring. We need to really counter it strongly, both in our politics, in our judgments, in civil society. And we need to change the narrative around this.
Okay. And, do you see that happening? Since we have amended a lot of things, do you see that happening?
I see it. I see some change happening, definitely. It's not like we haven't moved on at all. And especially judgments like Navtej Johar and then Joseph Shine versus Union of India, even Independent Thought, they all lay down the constitutional framework, the you know, the arguments really that you need to strike down a law like the exception to marital rape. And so we definitely see a change in judicial mindset as well. And I'm sure there are a number of politicians who also understand the problem with an exception like this. So it's really about reaching perhaps a critical mass of opinion. And that, I think, is still, we still have some way to go.
So, Mr. Sundaram, would you agree to that?
Yes, yes. As Shraddha has rightly pointed out, everything from Navtej Johar to Joseph Shine, Independent Thought, there is a roadmap. That the roadmap is readily available for either the constitutional courts or the parliament to sort of now act on this. But again, you know, I just want to stress three points. One is, we need to frame the entire discussion around rape as you know, an offense against bodily integrity. We need to emphasize the importance of the rights of the individual as laid down in Article 14. And we need to tell people that every act must be protected with consent, and consent cannot be given in an omnibus manner. I think if we do this, if these three points are understood, I think with the roadmap that is there, with the precedence that there is there, I think change is probably around the corner.
Shraddha, would you want to add to that? Or?
No. I think everything's been covered.
Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you both.